Okay, here's my question alongside of Joe's. Spikes of noise do give grief to a digital television demodulator system. If I make the spikes of noise as strong as I like, destroy that particular bit of data that's part of the packet, but because the packet contains a certain amount of error correcting, even though that data, from that particular bit of data, that particular symbol got destroyed, in many cases I believe the packet can put it back together because of the extra error correcting information that's given. But there's a catch. You can only have a certain number of dropouts per packet. So I guess if your particular power line noise in front of your house was one spike on the positive half and one spike on the negative half of the 60 cycle, 120 spikes per second, I think the system would tolerate it. But if your particular power line happens to make 1,000 spikes on the positive half cycle and 1,000 spikes on the negative half cycle, I think we've gone to the point where the error correcting cannot handle it. That's a guess on my part. I wonder if I'm close to Eric. K2EJ, K2LIW.
Okay, I let the whole system drop because I want to make sure that Ken hears. If he has something to say too, it's still not up. So let me let it drop for one more second. Okay, it's back. Here's the thing. The deal with error correction is not really the issue. The problem is synchronization for demodulation. Okay? It does take a certain number of clock cycles, let's say, for an oscillator to lock up. So if we do a burst of noise that occurs, so, say, 10 milliseconds, that'll be enough to kill a synchronization of the demodulator. So that is where the problems will come into play. Error correction, if you just lose a bit, no problem. If you lose 10 bits, no problem. If you do something that wipes out the pilot, you start to get into big trouble. I'm going to give it to you, and then let's let it drop, and let's let Ken pick it up. He's got something he wants to say.
Okay. By the way, when in 1982 this so-called technical net was resurrected, it was resurrected from the original amateur television and technical net of, why can't I think of his call letters right now, one of the founders of
W2KPQ.
That's the guy, W2KPQ, Ed Piller, in 1975-76. Thank you, George. He invented something called the amateur television and technical net. And it lasted for about a year, from 1975 to 1976, essentially. Then along came Mr. Koutsoupakis and Mr. Knadel in 1982 and created this particular technical net. And here we are getting heavy into television. History is repeating itself. We're going to let the machine completely drop, and then Kent is going to tell us whatever information or question he's got. So the A5VJB to take it with some delay. From Dallas, Texas, K2LIW in the tech man listening.
Okay, back on line here. Yeah, the impulse noise can be a bit of a problem, but the European system, the OFDM system, is vastly more sensitive to impulse noise. It takes far longer for the receiver to recover when it's interrupted. One little Vespa motorcycle going through a deeply village will shut down all of its TVs that have a lot of motorcycles running. We've worked with some companies that are developing what are kind of noise blinder circuits for TVs that help the European one. It doesn't solve the problem, but it helps quite a few TVs. Also, one issue that I write for a couple of magazines is Hicksville, there on Long Island. And in popular communications, we just published a build-it-yourself, high-definition TV antenna for reception. So this is a HDTV you can build for about $2 or $3. Most of us have enough trash stuff in the garage to build it for free. And the information can either be downloaded from the CQ website, or it's also can be downloaded from mine. So this is friendly construction information on how to build your own little extremely broadbanded Yagi for a few bucks, and covers UHF channels quite well, and even has moderate performance on VHF high. WA5BJ.
Yeah, that was some darn good information, and I know that some people are going to have a little trouble understanding it because of the noise that's on our local link. I sure wish the link from Fayetteville to, I guess, in Selden today was a little bit stronger and not quite so noisy. Kent, by the way, WA5BJB, is the publisher of the North Texas Microwave Society monthly newsletter. He's also on the board of directors for a number of clubs in the United Kingdom. Kent Britton is his last name, and he's well established in the country of Britain and goes over there to many of their microwave roundtables and microwave gatherings, and he publishes articles there as well as for CQ magazine. And Kent is mentioning that in one of his recent issues, I think it's of CQ ham radio, he has an antenna design that's easy to reproduce very inexpensively. Kent has a monthly or bi-monthly, quasi-semi-monthly article that appears on the subject of antennas in CQ Amateur Radio. So that's some of what you're hearing, and it's too bad you are not getting that information with a little bit better signal-to-noise ratio. I wish the guy in Sable had a little bit more power. I wonder if you want to add anything to all of this before we proceed with anyone else's questions tonight. KE2EJ. So take it, Eric, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, I think I'm listening to the output of 375, and it's not as good as it should be. There's something going on with the antenna with that thing. It could be the warm weather with the cold weather, but the antenna that we use is so shared with a lot of other folks. So it's not something that we might be able to do something about right away. But what I'll do is I'll probably put up a node here and get it into the system and go through the backbone, and we'll clear this problem up. So, is there anything else that you would like me to address at this point, specifically, Dick?
K2KEY, why would a question, Dick?
Yeah, I was about to pass it over to the group for questions. I know there's going to be a few. Mel first, you got it, Mel.
Okay, I didn't really get a good copy on Kent. He said something about homebrewing a antenna. For what? What is this homebrew antenna? Where is it featured? Over.
I think he's saying it's in one of the latest issues of CQ Ham Radio magazine. That it's a homebrew antenna intended for television reception inexpensively. If I understand correctly, let's let the machine drop. Let Kent, WA5BJB, come back and correct us on that. We were hearing a very noisy signal, so we're not quite sure. You got it, Kent, K2RIW. We'll give a delay.
That is correct, Dick. I'm also in keyboard contact with him, so we'll let him pick it up.
It's available from Popular Communications. It's available from Popular Communications, which is one of the magazines done by CQ Communications. It's also been written up in CQ VHF, and Michigan CQ. The original article can be downloaded from CQ Communications, or it can be downloaded from WA5BJB.com. Over.
K2AJWY, can I ask you a question?
You sure can, Joe. So, if you guys go to Kent's website, which is Whiskey Alpha 5, VictorJulietBravo.com, not only will you see his beautiful, inexpensive printed circuit green antennas for all kinds of frequencies from a few hundred megs to around 10 gigahertz, but he's got other sections of that website where he shows you how to homebrew inexpensive Yagi antennas. Joe, I know you got some further questions. So B2RYY, K2RYW on the TechNet.
Yeah, it can also be downloaded from Popular Communications.
Well done. Joe, with a little bit of delay.
Yeah, what I wanted to say is, or ask is, which will help the whole situation here, can the transceiver that's being used right now for Echolink, replaying this guy's transmission to the system, can that transceiver go to UHF?
Well, it could, but it's right now it's a 2 meter setup, so I don't know if you can change the frequency or not. Why the question?
Because I don't have a problem with my repeater. If the guy puts it on my repeater frequency, he can tie into your system and be pretty much full quieting. Repeater's over in Bayshore. From Sable to Bayshore, he can make it fly without any static on his signal. It would benefit everybody.
Now, this is our first crack at it. It used to work a lot better than it's working now, but we'll get it straightened out. Yes, I see it. Every new system has got some bugs in it that have got to be ironed out. So I think Kent is our first person to sign into the TechNet from out of the area. And Dallas-Fort Worth is down the road a piece, about 1,600 miles airline distance from here. I know that both Eric and Andy, the A2CDL, has for some time been telling me that, we can hook up things so that the TechNet can sweep a much wider area. And each time they said that to me in meetings, I said, I'm not in favor of that. The TechNet is running 4 hours per week now, essentially every Sunday. And if we had more people asking more questions, would we go more than 4 hours? It's ridiculous. Well, I was thinking a little bit short-sighted. Obviously, we're not going to extend the time, but maybe the quality of the questions and the quality of the answers, when we gather the clan, and that's what this is. The TechNet is a gathering of the clan. We share information. And boy, are we into television these days. And I guarantee also, although you take, for instance, Paul, WS2N, let me drop. Paul was quite worried that there's going to be an awful lot of grief with the new system. And for the first week, I think that's true. There's going to be people burning up the phone lines to all of the broadcast stations saying, what the hell did you do? I don't have television anymore. I can't watch my soap operas, and that's all I live for. There's going to be a certain number of those calls. And also Mel, K2KEY, told us about Senator Kruger's situation where there's quite a number of senior citizens in an assisted living center who right now do not have a master antenna television system in that building. Their only reception right now is rabbit ears, so to speak, a ghosty rabbit ear picture. And the experiments they've run to date have told them that when they hook a converter box onto that rabbit ear system, the digital reception is, for the most part, not there. At least their favorite program is not coming through. There's going to be a number of situations of unhappy people along those lines. We amateurs are pretty crafty people. I'm a little bit more optimistic than Paul and Mel in this particular area. I think we amateurs will volunteer to do something about those situations. Yeah, maybe it's going to require putting some RG6 cable in the drop ceiling of a building to create a poor man's equivalent of a master antenna TV system so that the outside signals can get into the individual converter boxes. That's one possible solution. With a number of senior citizens, with their usual amount of emphasis to the local government, will eventually get their message through that, hey, you guys have made a change, and although you've provided the $40 rebate coupon, you provided the $40 rebate coupon by which I can, for either $0 or $20 extra, I can get the converter box and I can sort of afford that. You've almost given me the ability to get digital television. But because of my particular living quarters, my particular layout of my the building that I live in, the assisted living facility I'm in, I don't have television reception. You missed the target in this one. Those people are going to make their point made. The relatives who visit them saying, what the heck is going on here? I'm going to get a hold of my congressman and we're going to correct the situation. So there's going to be some gnashing of teeth for a week or two. But I'm led to believe by all the things I'm hearing from Eric that the increased capability of digital television, of channel 4.1, 4.2, and 4.3, as well as 4.0, being present, where you've got three or four times as many channels being transmitted, and transmitted in high definition. I was over at my buddy's house tonight afternoon in Melville, and I saw what high-definition television can look like with a particular Sharp, I think it was, television set, a 48-inch Sharp. And, wow, I could count the hairs on the head of the lady who was in this very attractive picture. And so I think we're going to come out ahead. And
every transition is going to be troublesome. Every transition is going to have a few people that fall into the cracks that are going to be at a disadvantage. But are we doing the most good for the most number? I think the answer is yes. I don't have to ask Eric that question. He's a broadcaster, and he has seen the light. The rest of us are on the outside of the situation trying to find out, what do we do? What antenna do I buy? Do I have to have a rotator? How big does the antenna have to be? How high up do I have to put it? Is over-the-air reception, which is my favorite kind, still going to be there? Mel and I have one thing in common. We're the only person in our community using over-the-air broadcast television with a rooftop antenna. I can drive up and down almost every single street in Huntington. If I look real hard, I'll find one or two or three television aerials on the chimneys of houses with a disconnected transmission line where that antenna hasn't been used for more than 10 years and it hasn't rusted away and fallen off the roof yet. I'm the only guy with a real operating antenna both on my tower and on the roof of my house. Just so happens to be the kind of reception.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That happens to be the kind of reception I like to do. And there are a significant number of people in the metro area where some of the sets in the house are connected to the cable TV or the fiber optic or the satellite system. But at least one, two, or three other sets in the house are operating on rabbit ears because that set sits in the kitchen, and as the person eats his breakfast in the morning, he watches the news on a particular channel. That's all he cares about for that particular reception. And he gets a little bit of a ghosting in there on the rabbit ears. It doesn't bother him. And will that particular set get digital? On top of that, you'd be amazed how many homes have had 8 television sets in the house. Some of them hooked to cable, some of them hooked to fiber, some of them hooked to rabbit ears. There's going to be all kinds of combinations. We're going to be hearing about that in the time to come. Now, guarantee from what you guys have heard so far, you probably have some additional questions. What is this digital television? How do I make it work right for me? Do I have any choice? The answer is no. I mean, after the third major attempt, Congress finally got their act together saying, we are going to declare a real hard conversion date. No fooling this time. February 17th, 2009 is the day of reckoning. We will cease the majority of analog over-the-air television, except for some low-power TV stations and a couple of other exceptions. Everything's going digital. And we've been hearing about it now for a good fraction of a year. We've been giving lots of warning. It's not just, a bunch of people in a smoke-filled back room making a couple of decisions and keeping it a secret. There is no secret here. Anybody got any further questions? Give me your call letters right now. KCRIW on the TechNet. KC2OJO
with a comment.
Mr. OJO. I know you signed in before, but I'm so forgetful. Start off with your name. Go right ahead with your question. You got lots of time. I'll give a little bit of delay just to make sure everything resets.
My name is Howard, and my comment is on the WA5VJV antenna. I just wanted to put in a testimonial. I built that antenna shortly after it appeared in Popular Communications, and it works very, very well. There is one issue that most people who are going to use it end up needing something much more expensive, a rotator, depending on where they live, so that they can get stations that are located in different areas. Or, if they're lucky, maybe they can just switch between two of these Yagis and pick up almost everything. But unless you're going to be satisfied with just the Empire State Building, for instance, I think it's
going to
take a little bit more.
Very fine, Howard. If I understand you correctly, Howard, you're quite happy with the antenna that appeared in Popular Communications, article by Kent Britton, WA5EJB. And if I know Kent, almost every one of his articles uses very inexpensive materials. Chunks of wood and chunks of coat hanger wire and a couple of soldered connections and something like that. I guarantee the antenna uses no expensive parts. That's the kind of articles that Kent writes. You're worried that the rotator is expensive. And if I went and bought the latest Yaesu rotator and I spent $600 for it, without a doubt it's expensive. Sitting on my tower right now, a buddy of mine has an antenna that he wants to rotate, and I think he paid $29 for the rotator. and it's a digitally controlled rotator. The thing's been up there for 4 years. It's at the, I think it's at the 80-foot level of my tower, and it's moving a so-called chicken cooker. In other words, a 802.11 type, a 2.4 gigahertz parabolic dish antenna that is about 3.5 feet in diameter at the 80-foot level of the tower with this $29 rotator, which I think is still available. I'm too forgetful to remember the brand name. If I could walk out there to my tower later on tonight, I'll get you that brand name. So if you shop around to the right spot, there are rather high-performance, inexpensive rotators. So the rotator itself doesn't have to be expensive and do the job, in my opinion. I'm going to pass it back to you, Howard. Tell me a little bit of a guess as to the weight in pounds, the number of square feet of the antenna, and what do you think the rotator might have cost you before what I just said? KC2OJO to take it. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Radio Shack's $80.
$80 from Radio Shack. Okay. I think it's an even less expensive one than that, but let's see what Howard's going to say. You got it, Howard.
I think what I have seen is that generally they're around $80 for the rotator. What I spent, I don't think I spent $2. I probably spent about $5. I got the brass rod that made up the antenna from an Ace hardware store. I believe that I overbought. I wasn't quite sure. I know that sometimes if I buy very close to the exact amount of material, I'm going to mess something up and then have to go back, so I'll usually overbuy a bit. Use some scrap wood, and I happen to, of course, have the coax handy. So I think the antenna itself is very inexpensive, and by the way, I say the square footage, I don't think it's much over, I doubt if it's 1.5 square feet. Probably less than that. It's really quite small. It's really not meant, as far as I recall, for let's say, Channel 7. I think possibly it may start getting effective at Channel 13 and so forth. But the Channel 7, I think, is probably more than a little problematical. Over to you, Dick. KC2OGO, KC2OGO.
Information.
Okay, person with information, we're going to pick you up in a second. So it sounds to me like this is a UHF antenna. You're saying the results on Channel 7 were a little bit marginal. Howard lives in Greenlawn. Greenlawn, I think, is a healthy 35, 38 miles from New York City. Also, Greenlawn is on the North Shore. He is essentially in line with Janes Hill, the highest spot on Long Island. In other words, the signal he's getting from Empire State Building not only has to go 38 miles, and it has to clear Janes Hill before it gets to his particular QTH. I think that's essentially, I think Greenlawn is outside of the Baker cover area from Empire State Building. Let me hear Eric agree or disagree with me on that one. KE2EJ, K2LIW. Where was it? Howard lives in Greenlawn. And Greenlawn is directly in line with Janes Hill between him and Empire State Building. So I think he's outside of your B coverage area. And if this $5 antenna that he built from the article by Kent is giving him acceptable UHF reception, I'm pleasantly pleased. I think he's outside of the B area. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
Not as far as the FCC is concerned. He's still well with it. He's actually at the almost the edge of the A area, but Jane Hill is the problem. But the big question is, can he pick up Channel 13, which is 61? They only have a 1,000-watt transmitter that goes into the system. Don't forget they added the second antenna, the backscatter antenna, so the signals are 3 dB down from what they used to be 3 months ago. So if he gets 61, he's doing great.
KC2OJO, I did not get that many stations, and I certainly didn't get Channel 7 on VHF. I didn't mean to imply that. I went through the converter box, and I do have a problem in that I was only approximately, I would say at this point, maybe well, I'd say 15 feet up in the air. I think another 15 feet or so, and I'd probably be in much better shape.
Now, tell me this 45, if you are digital. There actually are no digital VHF at this point, so don't even consider it. After the 17th, then that changes. When the V's actually come online, they should come in like gangbusters, even where you are. A friend of mine just put up an antenna 30 feet up on his tower. He's in Huntington. He's actually a little closer than Dick is, and he has his issues. He has a trouble picking up a couple of them, but they are considerably low power. And the New York is an area which actually has, in my theory, they're creating their own problems by the... I actually believe there's some intersymbol distortion going on, which was never used to be there. If you have done your test, within the last 3 months, if you had done it, say, 6 months ago, your ability to receive would have been considerably different. So, Channel 13, which operates at Channel 61, let me get a drop. If you can pick that up, then you're doing really good. Everybody else is running about the same ERP. It's all coming out of the same antenna. The only difference is that Fox has their own antenna, and they share it with Channel 9, which is actually Fox. Mr. Murdoch bought that station, too. This is one of the markets, Kent, where there's one guy owns multiple TV stations. Used to be that was never allowed. Go up another 15 feet, you probably do a little better.
KC2AYG.
AYG recognized as the person with information before you. Let me ask Howard, though, a question. Howard, you said your antenna is 15 feet up. Does that mean the antenna is mounted inside your house? That's question number one. In the direction toward New York City, which is almost dead west from you, are you looking through the wall of a house and then looking through a forest of trees before the signal goes out to the horizon? And do you have the ability of putting the antenna outside the house, above the chimney, at a higher altitude? So you said the antenna is 15 feet up. I suspect that might mean that you're operating at the window inside of a house. Let's find out if that's true. KC2OJO, with some delay, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2OJO, here. You're very accurate, Dick. This is from inside the house, not through a window, through a couple of walls, and it was, I would say, right at the time the Popular Communication magazine came out. My guess is it was about 3 months ago, perhaps a little more, not quite sure. So it could be that some of the signals are stronger, but certainly I have a feeling that had it been outside, up above the roof, and as I said, about 30 feet high, that would not be that much higher than the height of my colonial, that it would probably work out even with James Hill in the way. Back to you, Zach.
Very fine, Howard. All of my experience has told me that every couple of feet of altitude you add to a VHF, UHF antenna makes a huge improvement in signals that are coming over that horizon. Altitude gives you a stronger signal. You come closer to clearing the trees that are in front of you, the buildings and the houses and the water towers and everything else. There's three things to make an antenna work well. Altitude, altitude, and altitude. One of the questions that Mel and I are frequently asked on the TechNet is, should I buy a zillion-dollar whiz-bang model X2500 antenna, an expensive antenna, and mount it close to the ground, or should I build a simple coat hanger antenna out of $1 worth of materials and mount it at a high altitude? And Mel and I always give the same answer, with rare exception. Go for the altitude. I don't care if it's a piece of garbage antenna, go for the altitude. It'll always help. Now, we had a person before Mr. AYJ. That person before him said, I've got information. Who was that? Start off with your call letters, your name, and then your information. I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick, and leave some delay.
Hi, Dick. This is KC2OES, Fred, and the Channelmaster model 9537, I bought those for as little as $59 plus maybe $11 shipping. I believe the company that sold them that I bought them from was called Solid Signal, just another lead there.
I think that's the one. I think it was a Channelmaster rotator for $59, which I had remembered it as $29. It is Channelmaster. It's coming back. It's the rotator that's been on my tower for a couple of years now, like 5 years, 4 years. It's rotating approximately a 3 or 4 foot diameter parabolic dish antenna intended for 2.4 gig reception. And so rotators don't have to be super expensive. Thank you very much, Fred. Mr. AXJ, give us your full call, your name, and your information or question. K2LIW, my name is Dick. Wait for the delay.
Call is KZ2AYG. The name is Guy. Also, formerly in the business with Eric. Besides having the antenna, I did a standard definition to digital HD conversion in a NBC affiliate down in Texas. We, as an experiment, we gave away some preamps to some of the people in the farther out DMA of the area. And the preamps actually worked phenomenal, as we heard. Now, for a cheaper antenna, how about a spool of solder just sitting on top of the TV, which will work as well?
Okay, now, you live in Bronx, New York, Guy, where, by my standards, you're fairly close to the Empire State Building. Therefore, in your location, some relatively simple antennas can work quite well. When it comes to adding a preamplifier to a television reception antenna, some people get a mixed result on that. In a rural area, the preamplifier, if it's got a 4.5 dB noise figure, we'll say, and the television set's got a 12 dB noise figure, that can make a great improvement. For a person who lives in a metro area or lives near strong signals like taxi cabs and dispatching services for oil and police and whatever, sometimes the preamplifier can create quite a bit of intermodulation distortion. So a preamplifier that has some kind of a bypass function, depending on what kind of a reception you're doing today, would be awful nice, and I don't think that's a commercial product. So I've heard mixed reviews on preamplifiers. I'm going to pass it back to you, Guy, for some further information on that one. What brand name, how many dollars, and are you recommending it for people in the metro, medium, and or rural areas? KC2AYG, K2RIW on the tech net. Wait for the delay.
KC2AYG, and hello to my friend Eric, KE2J. The simple $10, I think it's actually $5, 10 dB inline Rad Shack preamp. And let me specify where the station was. 15 miles away was Fort Hood, so we also had to deal with that problem. But even so, the preamp did work.
The reception the person had with and without the preamp, was he watching analog and or digital? Most likely digital. So he's watching a UHF digital channel with a 10 decibel gain inline preamplifier made by Radio Shack. I think you said $5. I'm a little bit amazed by that. I'm having trouble believing the preamp inline $5 with its wall wart power supply. That sounds a little too good to be true. So did he go from only one digital channel reception to five with the preamp? Was the preamp really that number of dollars with the wall wart? Any further words would be helpful, Guy. KC2AYG, K2LIW.
Yes, that is the price, and they are out there. And the thing is, with the preamp, now that was able to get the local HD channels, he was able to flip his, turn his antenna, and what came in the picture? was, besides the hours, the only 100 miles past us was Dallas, and flipped it around the other way south, Austin stations.
Well, if I remember correctly my geography, Austin from Dallas is, what, a healthy 500 miles? Am I in the right ballpark there, guy? Wait for the delay.
Okay. The NBC affiliate I was with was in Waco. So we were in the center of both of them. So it was like 125 towards Austin and 100 miles towards Dallas from us.
Okay. Kent always leads me to believe that Texas is very big, and I assume there's 500 miles between Dallas and Austin. Maybe it's only 200. Oh, well. Texas is big, but it's not that big. Let's see if Kent's got any words to add to all of this jazz. I'm going to give a little bit of delay and then pass it over to WA5 Victor Juliet Bravo. Let's hope that the signal-to-noise ratio on the link up here is a little bit better. And for those guys that are listening to this, it's going to be improved. This is our first attempt at somebody out of town, really out of town, 1,600 miles away, signing in. WA5 Victor Juliet Bravo to take it for any comments on any of the above. K2LIW on the tech net.
Okay, there we go. I think if you go from Brownsville to Dalmar, Texas, it's about 840 miles in a straight, pretty close to a straight line. Certainly have known guys who work 6 meters karate inside Texas. Austin's only about 200 miles. There was a website they put out for directing signal TV guys where Cap was doing long distance DTV reception, kind of like, you know, trying to pull in TV channels recorded and so forth. And he was in many cases locking up and getting visual pictures from transmitters 700-800 miles away. So you get the propagation just like you do anywhere else. In my case, looks like I'm going to have to build a big antenna if I want to watch the Dallas Cowboys from outside the blackout area when they move into that new massive stadium. So I may be trying to get 100 miles DTV. I do know one engineer who's about 100 miles from Dallas. He's got a 5-foot dish up on a tower. And right when he's on Dallas, DTV is about 800. The article for building your own is expensive. UHF TV antenna. I just sent a copy to Eric and a copy to you, Jake, so you have one in your in basket. You're welcome to forward those to any person who would like to build a UHF TV antenna for a couple of bucks. If that much, the most expensive part will be the U-Hole to build some back. Over.
Okay, a little bit noisy, but I got all of that. To repeat, what Kent has just done is he's taken the UHF television homebrew article, homebrew antenna article, he shipped a copy of it to Eric, KE2EJ, and to Dick, K2RIW, and so I can transfer it to anyone who wants it. He also mentioned that one of his buddies has been doing some digital television DXing, and if I understand correctly, 800 miles reception under certain favorable weather conditions did take place. Let me ask Eric this one. Eric, in the past, the really enthusiastic guys that love to do television reception DX observing would tolerate a very snowy picture with lots of ghosts and whatever, but as long as the television identification picture came on the screen and they took a photograph of it, proof of reception, and in many cases they would mail a copy of that to the television broadcast station and get the equivalent of a QSL card. But when it comes to digital television reception, having some grief on impulse noise and some grief on multipath, and when it comes to very long range, like 800 mile, 1,000 mile reception, the multipath, particularly with sporadic E and whatever, is going to really multiply, what's your gut feel as to should anything special be done on the nature of the digital television converter? Is that a worthwhile hobby is sort of what I'm getting at here. Do you believe that it's going to be a rare condition in which the amount of multipath is tolerable on, let's say, 800 miles?
Or am I worrying unnecessarily that when you really get a super long-range communication, there's really only one pass there, and it's easy for the digital converter to handle it? So should we super enthusiastic guys start putting a really high-gain television aerial with preamplifier on our tower with rotator to start doing some very long-range television reception if that's what turns you on? And occasionally that does turn me on. So what's your first impressions on this, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the deck net.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, interestingly enough, I've been doing quite a bit of DXing, and one day the UHF band was open on 440, actually it was on 432, and I decided to go looking for some digital TV DX. Now, I have reference receivers which don't need all the smarts in terms of, you know, finding a station and picking it up. If the signal will be had, it'll display it. It's actually a Sencor reference receiver. It's got third generation equalizer in it. Not that good, but I've been able to pick up the Boston stations on that day. I was also able to pick up one station in Vermont. And for about 5 minutes, I got a station that was in Portland, Maine. So, you go figure.
Wow. That's nice. Portland, Maine, to you, I'm guessing, is a healthy 400, 500 miles in that vicinity. It's down the road a piece. And that maybe was not without a preamp. Oh, yeah. Here's my real question now. Let's assume that I'm a television DXer. And I know that I'm watching the weather charts, I'm watching some kind of a satellite display or whatever. I know that a station in Chicago could possibly be getting to my backyard by way of some kind of a crazy propagation mode, multi-hop or whatever. And I know that that station is channel 52. And every time I turned on my converter and had it do scanning, there was no channel 52, so that's not in its memory. Will any of the television sets, will any of the converter boxes allow me to command the system to go to 52, whether it's there or not, in its memory? Or must I go through the reacquisition process in which it scans and finds out what's around, and I pray that at the instant of time it does the scanning, this QSB signal from Chicago is there? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2J. What I would probably recommend is find an old DTV receiver. Well, the reason for that is that as time goes on, as the manufacturers get a little more adept at doing this, their software gets much better. Okay? The newer receivers are expecting to see the PSIPs. Okay? That's that protocol that has all the stuff that tells it all about what it's receiving. The older receivers, like an RCA DTC-100, old Panasonic, they're not the best receivers. But you just tune it to channel, you go count 52-1, and it expects to find the DTV signal. Either say weak signal or no signal, or you're going to get a picture. The newer converter boxes are expecting to get that information. Okay, you can actually direct dial any of the boxes, alright? The question is, are you getting enough of a stream for a long enough period of time? Because a lot of this information is not sent every second. Some of it is on a 30-second cycle. Some bits of information don't happen for every 3 minutes. The guide information may be every 3 hours. So it depends upon the generation of receiver that you're working with. But all receivers can be commanded to go directly to a channel. But in a lot of cases, if it doesn't see anything, especially if it... Now, I'm not talking about the newer converter boxes because they don't have an NTSC receiver tuner in it. But some of the good sets, the new sets, which have the NTSC receivers in it, if you go, say, channel 52-1, it doesn't see anything within 3 to 5 seconds, it'll switch over to analog. And then that's life. K2RW, K2J.
K2RY.
Joe recognized. I'm getting the impression, Eric, that the software idiot-proofness of the modern-day set is starting to override what I want to do. I'm getting less and less manual control. If it doesn't find that channel 52.1 in a few seconds, it does something else. And it won't stay there and wait for the right information to come through to keep me happy. And I'm not going to ask you immediately, but I'm going to go over to Joe first, but eventually I'm going to come back to you and ask, is there any way I can override? Do I have to get into the software of the microprocessor, which is very difficult, I suspect, in order for me to force the set to sit on 52, because I really want to watch that Chicago station. I don't care that the Chicago station is only coming through for 10 seconds at a time, once every 3 minutes. I want it to sit there and keep trying. And I think you're saying the darn thing with its intelligence is going to say, hey, there's nothing there, let's give up. And I want to be able to override that. Let's see what Joe's got to ask here. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, with some delay, K-2-R-I-W.
Okay, the receiver I have that was given to me by a friend of mine is a Magnavox TB110MW9A. I don't know anything about it as far as if it's good, bad, or indifferent, old, new, or whatever, but it is what it is. I did have some time to experiment with this thing and found out that if I rescan channels, yes, it'll pick stuff up, but sometimes it'll pick up channel 2. I can typically get channel 2, sometimes 5, 21 and 67 and 55. I can always get channel 67 digital and 55 digital. I mean, 55 and 21 digital. Can't always get channel 2. Now, knowing that I get channel, say, 21 and 67 pretty strong digitally all the time, I purposely jammed the pilot signal with my signal jammer to actually see what I did to actually take it out, which is only about a signal less, a little less than 10 dB, the signal strength of the pilot signal, and you can make the thing blink up and lose the signal. Once it does that, sometimes it'll come back. If I purposely will let the thing scan with that channel being interfered with during the scanning process, it doesn't see the channel, and later on, when the channel is there, it will not pick it up. Either if I directly dial the converter to that channel, like 67.1 or 21.2, it will not pick up the channel.
Interesting. So, I'm seeing another possible approach here, Joe. I'm going to ask Eric about this one. If I'm smart enough to have a good synthesized signal generator where I can dial in a pilot signal, 300 and some odd KC from the low end of a particular channel number, by me giving the converter a pilot frequency, even though it doesn't have the right modulation on it yet, can I force it to sit there? In other words, I periodically inject this into the antenna in order to force the converter to sit on that channel, because I really want to watch channel 52, because the weather charts are telling me that periodically it's going to come through from Chicago, and I want to get that photograph off the screen. I wonder if I'm wasting my time trying to do that. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
MPW add-on.
One comment, Dick. It does exactly the reverse of what you're thinking of. The carry will not be seen by the digital converter. Once you put a carrier on that pilot frequency, even close to its amplitude or slightly above it, it will not see it. And if you put the pilot signal, the carrier on the pilot signal, it'll ignore that frequency. It does not store it and think there's something there. It completely ignores it. That was my point.
Dick?
Okay, who is that?
Okay, why don't you pick up the other station that broke it, and I'll give you an answer.
Okay, the new station who just signed it, give us the full set of calls and a name, and go right ahead.
W2, Papa Whiskey, was that me?
I think so. Go right ahead, Papa Whiskey. Start off with your name, sir.
Thanks. Name is Press. An add-on to what Joe was saying. Joe seemed to be saying that if you go through a scan and the channel is missing by being blocked, it will be dropped from the scan list and never be seen again until rescanned. I have a similar effect, but this different question. If I hook up a TV to an outside UHF antenna and do a scan and pick up a variety of channels, I've never once picked up channel 13 because, as he indicated, it's got a lower power signal. I'm out in Patchogue. However, it is present in the scan list as a non-receivable channel. I'm wondering if any of the channels have additional information on all of the channels. If not, then how come my TV is expecting to see channel 13-1, but never, ever got a signal? W2PW.
Mr. OOA, very weak, recognized. We'll get back to you in a minute. Eric, over to you.
All right, just correct me as far as what the other gentleman said about, did he say that he could see the pilot signal? Is that, did somebody say that?
He never gets channel 13, which I think is really channel 61. However, is if I understood correctly, I think he's saying that his indicator is telling him that there should be a 13 there. Press, give us a repeat on that one, Press.
Okay, two people, two effects. Joe was saying if he blocks a strong channel and scans, and it's omitted from his scan list, he cannot see it again until he rescans again and picks up again. I think that's what Joe was saying. What I'm saying is if I connect a TV to a UHF antenna and I pick up a variety of New York City stations, however, I have never seen channel 13. It's never been strong enough to be present, yet it is present in my scan list. In other words, if I cycle through, it says it's there, but there's nothing there. Is it possible the TV picked up on channel 13-1 but never got a usable signal to display TV? Or is it that the other New York City stations are saying, okay, here's the complete list of New York stations. Are they all cross-referencing each other? Eric?
Okay, I got what you're saying. That in the receiver there's memory. Okay, and when you do a scan, what it generally will do, and it depends on the receiver manufacturer, it will delete that table. And as it scans, it creates a new table. Right? You can actually have a weak signal, get the input phase lock loop to lock up long enough to get what's used for the synchronization of the receiver. And the first group of packets will be what's called a TSID, or a Transmitter Signal ID. It can actually decode the TSID, load it in the table, but you will not actually have enough signal strength there to deal with a high bit rate image. In some cases, some receivers, even though you have a really weak signal, it might be able to pick up the low rate repetitive data. Again, depends on the receiver manufacturer. And as far as the other guy is concerned, some receivers, as soon as you hit the scan button, empties the map in that table and fills it up. If it doesn't see the station as it goes past it, as far as it's concerned, it doesn't exist. K2RW, K2J.
Okay, we're learning the quirks of these systems. Let's see what Paul's got to say about all this. KC2OOA, I think it was. K2LAW, you got it, Paul.
K2RAW, K2OOA. Hopefully that will listen to you. It's useful. And the only channels that send each other's data out are 5 and 9. And 5 and 9 are the reverse of each other on each other's channels. So on 5, 5-1 is on 5. 5-2
is WOR, and on 9, 9-1 is WOR, and 9-2 is Fox 5.
KC2, OOA is
Fox 5. I wonder if you understood that one, Eric.
No, his audio is too low for me. I can barely hear him.
Okay. When he tunes to channel 5, 5.1 and 5.2, one of them is OR, and one of them is Fox. And when he goes to 9.1 and 9.2, he gets the exact reverse. One of them is Fox, and one of them is OR. So he's kind of curious as to why it does that. Over to you, Eric.
All right, that's an easy one to explain. First of all, WWOR is owned by WNYW. They're both owned by Rupert Murdoch, so that's why the association with the two channels. If he's using a converter box, he doesn't know what the difference is. If he's using a real set that's got high definition, you'll find out that 5.1 is channel 5's high def signal. Actually, let's call it 16:9 widescreen. It's only recently that they really started doing high def. A lot of this stuff is still 525, 16:9. Not necessarily high def, but let's call it high def. The first high def program Fox put on was the Super Bowl. That was in 720p, not 1080i. So 5.1 is the high def signal. WWOR is 5.2, which is standard definition, and actually at a pretty low bit rate. The picture quality is just
somewhat poor. When you tune to WWOR, 9.1 is their high def signal, which is 720. It started out being 1080, but it's 720. And 9.2 is WNYW's standard definition picture. So that's why you see them both in reverse. But if you have an HD set, you'll see that 5.1 is HD and 9.1 is HD, and the sub-channels are standard definition.
It's getting more and more complicated. No, it makes sense. And we got to learn all these, got to learn a whole lot of brand new pieces of information about television, how it works, what it means, how to interpret the numbers, how to scan the darn thing to find the channels, how to tune to the channels, what's required for good reception. We're all in a learning curve. I'm pretty sure we're going to come out ahead when this is all, when the smoke finally settles, but it's going to be a couple of rough periods in the beginning of February and the beginning of March. I see it coming. But I think if we'll all settle out, we're going to survive. This is a, what's the word I'm looking for here? This is a somewhat luxury item. It's not exactly a life and death situation here as to whether or not you get all the television reception you want at the instant that digital television becomes the norm. And if I'm not hearing correctly, there are certain television channels in certain areas of the United States that have been transmitting digital television for over 10 years. So various communities have had the opportunity to get used to this stuff and to start experimenting with it. The biggest thing that happened, though, with the friends I was visiting in Melville was that a number of those guys had, in the last week, in getting ready, taking the VHF / UHF television off the house, chopped it up and threw it away, not realizing that VHF upper channels 7 through 13 will persist beyond February 17th of 2009. As you read the various FCC websites and NAB websites and whatever, they emphasize the fact that UHF channels 14 through, we'll say, 50-something are transmitting digital television now, and in the future will be transmitting digital television. But many of the major networks, after February 17th, where right now they're transmitting analog television on channels 2 through 13, many of them will go back to digital television transmission on channels 7 through 13 in the New York area. And in certain other areas, they'll be transmitting digital television on channels 2 through 6. New York area is not one of those. So you do need a VHF upper.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As I see it, you do need a upper VHF 7 through 13 aerial as well as UHF. And so my friend who found out about this through a conversation we had this afternoon, he's a bit unhappy about the fact that he's destroyed his VHF antenna. He's now going to go out and buy another one. And that represents a bit of a problem. 6 months ago, I wanted to do some television DXing, and I walked into Radio Shack and I said, hey, your catalog used to show the super high gain VHF / UHF antenna, a 2 through 84 channel antenna. I want to buy that. And they said, you're in luck. We just happen to have one left that's been there for years. They go into the back room, they pick up this great big box which has got 2 years worth of dust on it, and they hand me that antenna. I think right now, if I walked into Radio Shack tomorrow morning and try to buy a VHF antenna, I'm not sure they've got one. I'm not sure. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding going on here. I know that after February 17th, the majority of the people in the New York area are going to want a channel 7 through 13 antenna, as well as 14 through 50-something antenna. So, Eric, to your knowledge, is Radio Shack continuing? Are they going to restock VHF antennas? I thought I bought the last one for my local Radio Shack dealer, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
WS2N, I have an antenna question.
We'll get you right after Paul. Eric, go ahead, Eric.
Well, I'm not a representative of Radio Shack, but I will go to their website and see if they still list it. I'm sure they will continue to. If you look at the like antennaweb.org or the place where you go to order your coupon, you will find that everywhere in big letters
that you need a UHF slash VHF.